Good evening. This is Milton Rosenberg. Welcome again to Extension 720.
Good evening. This is Milton Rosenberg. We welcome you again to Extension 720.
Good evening. This is Milton Rosenberg. Welcome again to Extension 720. Hello to all. This is Milton Rosenberg.
We'll talk about that tonight on Extension 720. Extension 720 here on 720 WGN. I'm Justin Kaufman with you for the next couple hours till 10 o'clock. 312-981-7200 is our phone number. Welcome to another beautiful night in Chicago. Friday night, the city. I don't know if it's possible. It's the end of your work week. You're sitting on a porch, sipping on an adult beverage or child's beverage. You drink. Or possibly you're starting your work week, or maybe you're getting out of town or coming back in. Whichever which way you are living your Friday night, we are here with you on Extension 720. Lots to do tonight. I have to say, you know, we could do a show or we do a lot of entertainment and what to do this weekend, all that kind of stuff. But nonsense. Why would we do that when it was such a busy week when it came to Chicago news? Trump aside, right? You could do many, many hours on what's happening in Washington. But here in Chicago, lots to talk about, including what we heard David Jennings mention about Lori Lightfoot, the mayor of Chicago, slated to do a primetime speech on August 29th to talk about what looks to be a $1 billion shortfall in the upcoming budget for the city of Chicago. Now, that's a big number. It's bigger than what was once thought when the mayors were... or when the candidates were gearing up, running for mayor earlier in 2019, the number was a lot smaller. I think that they were talking about, it's ridiculous to say smaller, but $700 million. And it looks like it's more. So how is the mayor going to deal with this? She had already said at one point that Chicago residents should get ready for tax increases. But coupled with the Cook County property tax increase we saw this year, which many people continue to sort of be in shock from seeing their bill that came to them this past month. How can you do that? How are you going to be able to raise property taxes? And I know reading the articles today that Mayor Lightfoot was saying maybe the thought is that maybe she'll raise taxes on the more wealthy in town, but I have to say that just happened. Cook County, you just saw that there wasn't the last time around, it wasn't the sort of an equitable tax increase. It affected mostly the central and central area of the city and the north side of Chicago, the more wealthier areas of the city and the county. So what's she going to do? Is she going to double dip? That's the question I think a lot of people are asking, to see if she possibly has the clout and the mandate. I mean, she was elected with 74% of the vote to raise taxes on residents that just had taxes raised. That's going to be the question. Very interesting that it is August 9th. Today's the 9th. August 9th. And this stuff is leaking out 20 days, 3 weeks before she's supposed to take the podium in a live address to the city. Which she hopes, my favorite part of the article was that she hopes that it will be televised. They hope it will be televised. Like they were taken live. I call it the Chicago Seal. You know, she'll stand in front of the podium. Good evening, fellow citizens. Like one of those speeches. Have we ever done? You ever see those in Chicago? You know, rarely ever see those. I'm sure it's happened at some point or another in modern day, but I can't think of any time where Mayor Daley. I've lived in Chicago all my life, and I feel like I don't remember him standing in front of a podium in a live setting like they do in from the Oval Office. Certainly not Mayor Emanuel. So yeah, it'd be kind of awesome. You know, people get together for watch parties. No, we're not going to do that.
You know, there are two options. It's not just about raising taxes. It could also be something else.
What do you think?
What are you willing to give up?
Oh, yeah, like cut some services.
Mm.
But that's the pool. See, I'll have a watch party at my house, and there'll be a pool that will, you know, you think it's going to be what service is going to be cut, what tax is going to be raised. And if you get the square, you get more nachos or whatever it might be. That's the party that I'm going to have. You're on the fence. You're on the fence, David, if you're invited. I haven't decided yet if I'm going to bring you around. We'll see. How are you tonight, David?
Actually, quite good.
Yeah, good. Nice to do a couple shows
nice
in
weather.
A row here. Nice weather, yeah.
The air conditioning is just right in here.
All right, good. Coming up on the show tonight, Jeff Cohen stopping by. I mentioned that to Brian in the crosstalk. Jeff Cohen, a longtime investigative reporter for the Chicago Tribune. He also covered the Blagojevich trial, and he wrote the co-wrote the book with John Chase called Golden, which is one of the books that came out of that trial. It's a great book. The actual title is Golden, How Rod Blagojevich Talked Himself Out of the Governor's Office and Into Prison. Today, he wrote a piece about five things that aren't being talked about or that we don't remember from the Blagojevich trial that have impact on what's happening with the idea that the sentence would be commuted from President Trump. So Jeff Cohen stopping by right after the 7:30 news tonight. Marion Sobe's going to be here. Marion Sobe, longtime journalist here in Chicago. She broadcasts on a different station. Yeah, we'll just put it that way. She is also a Second City comedian. She is doing a new show called Headscarf Above Water, which is just a two-week run at Second City. The last show is tomorrow night, but she's got the night off tonight, so she's coming by to talk about her one-woman show, which really is a send-up, if you will, on being a Muslim woman in Chicago. So we'll talk with Marion. So great. I've worked with Marion years ago. And I enjoyed being co-workers, I haven't seen her in a long time, so it'd be great to have her in studio. So she's coming up in the 8 o'clock hour. And also, the 9 o'clock hour, and I mentioned this to Brian as well, Brandon Hendrickson, Mr. Olympia. I mean, you remember Pumping Iron? Pumping Iron was the Arnold Schwarzenegger movie that before he was Albie Bach, he was a competitive bodybuilder. Well, this is the new age of competitive bodybuilding, and it's happening at a championship rate right here in Chicago. Brandon Hendrickson, a Chicago kid, won Mr. Olympia last year. He's defending his title in Las Vegas coming up in September, so he's beginning to train. He was gracious enough to let us come up to his Northwest Side gym, and we're going to talk with him coming up in the 9 o'clock hour about what it takes to compete in such a tournament and how you go about building your body that way. Even if today, Pete, I was like, oh man, I'm going to start building this body. I don't know how I would get to that point where you look, with the, just big ham hocks everywhere. Your wrist looks like a cartoon ham hock. How do you do that? I don't even know. I mean, you're in shape. You're a guy who, does Orange Theory. You get it going. You're one of the top, I would say, competitive exercisers in town.
Half of the Orange Theory class is working with weights. And I've learned that in order to build some muscle, you have to lift more than 8 pounds. I like the 8-pound dumbbell.
Like 8 pounds. Right, right. Something tells me Brandon's not doing he's past the 8 pounds.
I think he's past the 8 pounds.
Yeah, there's a lot of videos of him because he was also in the Netflix special that was kind of like the update on Pumping Iron. And there's videos of him doing kind of lifts, with his arms where he's just got one arm and he's lifting this huge. I'm like, I would never in my wildest dreams even think of doing that lift in a gym. Like, even if I had a dumbbell, the 8-pound dumbbell, I would never be like, what if my arm went like this? That's what he's doing. And it's just building these parts of his arms and legs and his muscles and his abs. And it's not even like a six pack. We're talking how Budweiser went to like the 18 pack. It's like an 18 pack. It's impressive. We'll put some pictures up on Instagram so you can get a better look at Brandon Hendrickson tonight. So all that coming up on Extension 720. We're also going to talk, we got a download in Chicago Business about very interesting when it comes to the medical community and the medical industry, technology and how it's used to better the hospital visit and the hospital stay. And we're seeing the startups being funded over and over and over to expedite and to make that process better. And we're going to talk with Paragon Biosciences about this because when it comes to just detecting cancers, in particular breast cancer, anyone who has gone through that and mammograms and gone through biopsies knows what that experience is like. And Paragon is trying to eliminate the biopsy by using technology to essentially do a much more non-invasive experience. So that conversation as well tonight on Extension 720. So lots to do. Pete's here. David Jennings here. We got a big show, so we'll take a break and we'll get to it. So stay with us. So much to talk about tonight. I was, just sort of perusing the news before we start, and I came across Ted Cox has a great story, the one Illinois one, about the Asian carp. Now, this is something that we haven't talked much about, because you remember 10, 15 years ago that the Asian carp were in the Illinois River, and they were getting close. They were in Kankakee area, and they were getting close to Lake Michigan. And we have talked with the Army Corps of Engineers and the Department of Natural Resources. We're going to put billions and billions of dollars into it. They cannot get into Lake Michigan. It has now been, 10-plus years, at least? I think it was in 2008 we were doing those kind of stories, and they still aren't in the lake. And there's a question why they stopped. The Asian carp have stopped at a certain point, I think where the Kankakee River and Illinois River kind of come together, where it's essentially the next step is to move into the Chicago waterways. And a University of Illinois study has said that the reason they have stopped is because of water quality and because of pollution. That these fish are not used to the Chicago gross that is coming down the river. And I guess when it gets to this spot in the Illinois River is when most of the pollutants kind of die off and the water quality gets better. So at that part in the Illinois River, they're like, oh, this is great. And they keep going. And we've heard these are ferocious, I don't want to say ferocious. They'll eat anything. They'll move anywhere. They're not stopped by anything. That's why even a fence isn't going to stop them. But it turns out that it looks like the crap we put in our water or the pills that we dump into the sewers is emptying out into the Illinois River that way, and it's stopping them. And it's making it's a great science story, because it's what it's doing. And this Ted's a great reporter, and I want to get these researchers on. Is it's overworking the fish's liver, because it can't handle all of the toxins that is coming its way. And this is everything from ibuprofen to the pharmaceuticals that get dumped down to the human waste, everything that you can imagine would be in the Illinois water or the Chicago water. It can't handle it. And it's not only overtaxing the liver, and this is the part where it gets so fascinating to me, it's changing their gene structure. The fish are actually, I don't know what you call it, releasing or engaging with different gene structures to deal with the fact that all of this garbage, they're absorbing all this garbage. And so they are not moving forward because of Chicago pollution. It's an outstanding story. So finally, our grossness is actually maybe helping us.
But is this gonna be something that's gonna make these carp stronger?
Oh, yeah, I don't know about that. That's a great point. Like, do they adjust?
Yeah.
Like, in 10 years, they become kind of like a monster fish. He's like, nothing can stop me. I don't care about your birth control pills that you jumped down the drain. I don't care. I'll eat anything.
It's a good impression.
Thank you. That's my Asian carp. Yeah, I just love that. It's just amazing to me, because you don't really think at all about why those fish stopped. Because we still haven't built this. There are electric barriers. And I will say that the Illinois Department of Natural Resources, according to the story and Ted's story, they've been pulling millions and millions of pounds. That's what they do, but pounds of these fish out of the river every year. Whether it's catching them or netting them or whatever. They have reduced the Asian carp population in the Illinois River by 96% by doing that. But there's still the question, because, you've seen these. They're, like I said, they'll keep going. Why 100 of them didn't keep going? And there's a certain point where they just stop and they're like, no thanks. Nah, no thanks. Not unlike, I think, a lot of suburbanites. They're like, nah, I don't need to go downtown. Downtown's not for me. You know what? We'll just stay right here. The schools are better out here. Don't have to deal with crime. We'll just stay right here on the banks. This Illinois River's cozy. Let's set up shop here. Isn't that amazing? It's a great story. And I wonder that, as they point out, this is not sort of carte blanche for us to continue our pollution ways. We'd still have to clean up the environment. But this is one way in which pollution has actually helped in deterring the Asian carp. Wow.
I got a question for you.
It's a great Friday story, isn't it?
I got a question for you.
Yes, please, shoot.
if it has that effect on the Asian carp, since I wondered, do the water recycling plants filter out those meds we dump? If not, what's that going to do to us?
Yeah, well,
just a thought. Just,
you know what? That's why I keep drinking tap water, because I'm a risky guy, and I just want to see what it see if it like
living dangerously.
I've never really thought about it, because I live in a spot where I have tap water and I drink it all the time. It's actually something that I don't filter it at all, and it's one of these things that in my life I've been like, no, it's good. You know what? I can dance. But now I'm a little bit more with lead and everything else. I'm like, well, there's nothing really you can do to hurt me at this point. I mean, I'm in my 40s, but you know,
as Bert Natera said, Chicago water is great.
Exactly. Whatever's good for Nateris.
But somebody in our neighborhood test their water tested for lead. Uh-oh. And they left a really scribbly note on everyone's house to say that, hey, we tested lead. For lead. You should test your house. So I've sent in for the lead kit.
Oh, yeah. You're not going to get
it. It's been sitting in the same spot where I got it in the door. It's been sitting there for like 3 weeks. I've done nothing and still shoveling tap water in my mouth.
You're afraid of what you might find?
Yeah, that's what it is.
Oh. Mm-hmm.
I have a feeling he's going to do it, and then it's going to come back and say, you have Asian carp. That's going to be it. All right, we'll take a quick break. We'll come back. Jeff Cohen's coming up right after the news. We'll talk Blagojevich and what we have forgotten about that infamous trial. It is Extension 720. Stay with us. Thanks, David. Extension 720 here on 720 WGN. I'm Justin Kaufman. Okay, so there has much been made of the former Illinois Governor Rod Blagojevich and whether or not his sentence will be commuted by the President of the United States, who on Air Force One the other day suggested that he was strongly considering it. He backtracked a little bit on Twitter, telling people that he was going to. Many people have asked him to study this, and he's going to see what he can do. But I think the story here for Chicagoans and for those who paid attention to the trial is trying to remember everything about it, because you hear when the president is talking about, you know, he was treated unfairly or this sentence was way too long, you start to question, well, maybe he's right, or I don't remember much about the details, but my next guest does. Jeff Cohen was an investigative reporter who covered the Blagojevich trial. He's also the co-author of the book Golden, How Rod Blagojevich Talked Himself Out of the Governor's Office and Into Prison. He continues to work. His fine work can be seen in the Chicago Tribune, including today, where he wrote the piece Sorting Truth from Myth in Former Illinois Governor Rod Blagojevich's Conviction, Five Things to Know. Jeff, great to see you, man. Thanks for coming in.
Thanks very much.
Friday night, too. I appreciate that.
You know, what else am I going to do?
I was going to say, life must be humming for you about now. Right? Let's get to it. Well, were you surprised? Because this is not the first time that the president has kind of bantied this about. But were you surprised that this week it came up?
Yeah, I think it caught everybody by surprise, because it was last year, the last time Trump did this. It's been a year plus, actually, since the last time. And, you know, the cynics out there would say, maybe he's using this just as a distraction. Maybe it's no accident that he was coming back from El Paso and it was on Air Force One and some of the, you know, publicity around that trip wasn't going well. And so he throws a new shiny object in front of the press and everybody jumps on it. That's possible.
It's possible. But for you to see, I mean, because there have been a number of appeals. You've seen Patty Blagojevich being a pundit, if you will, on Fox News and talking about this. So it is something that obviously over the last couple of years continues to pop up. It's not like he's just sitting in prison and forgotten about. The Blagojevich saga continues to be on at least, if not front page news.
Right. Well, he had just about run out all of his legal options the last time this happened. And you're correct that I think that one caught people even more off guard. Trump just kind of came out with that he thought that, you know, Rod had been treated unfairly and that maybe, you know, it was time to revisit that. And at the time, you know, as you recall, he was under a little bit more jeopardy because the Mueller investigation was still going, and he had kind of conflated this into, oh, it's the same guys who are picking on Rod that are picking on me now, and people thought maybe he was using it as a way to stick his thumb in their eye, to the point where none of the clemency paperwork was even filed at that point. You know, his lawyer scrambled after that to put that in.
Yeah, right.
But you're right. I mean, Patty kind of launched her own publicity campaign, went, you know, not surprisingly, right to Fox News, and you know, as many times as she could, was, you know, hailing Trump as you know, the wisest president in the history of the United States, who would certainly make the right decision about her husband.
Pretty savvy.
Right, sure.
Yeah, I mean if you're going to do it, do it.
Yeah, yeah, she's, I mean, everybody knows, you know, she comes from a political family here and is certainly street smart, and I'm sure can, you know, maybe run circles around a lot of people in Washington these
and
days.
You can get all of, you know, the Illinois Republicans and some of the Republican delegation, and Mayor Lightfoot, Governor Pritzker, who shows up on some of those political language tapes at the time, everybody weighing in on everything. But I want to go back because I thought it was interesting that a couple of lines on Air Force One and a couple of tweets seemed to reshape the narrative of this trial. And it seems like we're kind of backtracking and people are forgetting about what actually went down. So let's start. The one thing, and it's the first question you tackle in your piece today, is really about the 14-year sentence and whether or not that was unusual or too much for this case.
Yeah, I think in a vacuum, you know, that's something that a lot of people bring up because 14 years just feels long. And in the federal system, you have to serve 85%. So for Rod, that means he's not supposed to get out even still until May 2024. So it just feels long, you know, and that's without question, you know, even in some of the recent public corruption cases that we've seen here,
right,
that's longer than average. And George Ryan, who was the, you know, governor right before Rod, got 6.5 years for the, you know, licenses for bribes scandal.
Which so, actually you could see correlated into people actually getting hurt and killed because the exactly. family was crashed on the expressway. But anyway, yeah.
So it just feels long. And people, you know, I don't think that Rod was necessarily on the surface an unlikable guy. I think he was, you know, seen as a Chicago character. And he did the, you know, the late night TV show circuit and people were entertained by him. And they know that he has a family that includes a couple of, you know, younger daughters. And nobody wants to see, you know, anybody kind of deal with that, especially when, you know, in a lot of people's minds, he wasn't some master criminal or, you know, wasn't responsible for killing anyone.
And, right.
You know, what are we really doing here if we have Rod Blagojevich locked up this long?
So, right.
It's a natural question.
So, but when you're thinking about what went down in the courtroom to get this kind of sentence, what went right. into it? Why 14 years?
Well, if you remember in 2008, when he was charged and then he was indicted in 2009, especially the indictment, I think was really shocking at the time. He was basically accused of running the entire government of the state of Illinois as a criminal racket. I mean, that's the extent of the language that was in there. So when you start looking at what he was accused of doing, I mean, the sentence that he got was within the guidelines that, you know, the federal system uses. Actually, prosecutors, after he was convicted, sought 15 to 20 years from this judge, and he actually, you know, came in under what the government wanted, which I think, you know, by and large, if you were to look at the averages, is probably unusual. I mean, most of the time, mm-hmm. judges, you know, tend to line up
right.
with where the government goes.
But that is a striking way to think about this and reshape this narrative, that the prosecution accused Rod Blagojevich of running a criminal racketeering ring out
yeah.
as the state of Illinois. I mean, that's crazy to think about.
I mean, the indictment used language like the Blagojevich Enterprise, which basically was state government. And that the case grew out of something called Operation Board Games, which it's probably been 10 years since people heard that term. But basically, Blagojevich operators, people like Tony Rezko, had figured out ways to plant not even just loyalists, but people who would literally do whatever they were told. And put them in place in some of these boards and commissions. And when you do that and you have a majority that will do whatever you want, you can be out in the street saying to people who want things like investment money from the teacher's retirement system, if you give this amount or you pay this amount, you will get this amount of funds you know, from the teacher's retirement system. And it was millions of dollars at the time, and it meant hundreds of thousands of dollars in fake finder's fees for these guys.
It's amazing, too, and obviously it's hard not to think about what's happening right now at the federal government level and some of the investigations that are going into, and even the president who says some of these things straight up, saying, I want yes people in boards and especially in judge seats. But let's talk about the issue, and the second question you kind of pose about this. You'll hear people who support Blagojevich and support the president wanting to compute the sentence, that all he was doing was talking. He was just talking. You got him on tape talking, but he never actually did anything.
Right, which is a defense that kind of resonates with Blagojevich, because let's face it, it's true. I mean, we've all seen him on TV and heard him on radio, and all he does is talk. That is accurate. But there were a couple of key moments where they felt like his intent was revealed, you know, a couple of tapes. The way you speak on a, you know, wiretap is much different than you would speak on the radio.
Right.
And so there are a couple of things that they thought really provided a window into what he wanted to do. So a lot of his alleged, you know, plans and plots from his view were really political. He was trying to work a deal where, you know, maybe he would appoint Lisa Madigan to the Senate seat in exchange for that. You know, Michael Madigan would push his agenda through Springfield. That's more political horse trading. You know, you probably don't get charged if that's what you're trying to do. But you start trying to do things like bring in more than $1 million in campaign funds, you know, campaign contributions to appoint somebody like Jesse Jackson, and you send your brother to meet with the right people who are offering that kind of money to prosecutors. That was a step to try to bring in something for yourself, a benefit for yourself. Or you try to, you know, bargain with the new Obama administration at that time and try to get an ambassadorship for yourself, or he wanted to be, you know, he wanted to run Health and Human Services at the time, something like that. That's a paying job.
Right.
So that's money to you in exchange for an exercise of your political power.
And I want to take a break, but before we do that, the other thing as well is people say, well, he never actually pocketed any money, right? The money was never exchanged. This was just him talking. Is that true?
That is also true. I mean, a lot of these deals were not consummated. However, you know, people have to remember, especially the first trial, I think it was emphasized a little bit more. They had a key advisor named Lon Monk on the stand, and he actually testified that Blagojevich himself, Lon Monk, Tony Rezko, and Chris Kelly, who was another fundraiser and advisor, had kind of agreed amongst themselves that especially Rezko would work some of the things that they had going. They would make a lot of money on the side. They would put it in an account that nobody knew about. And then when Rod got out of office, they would split this up. And, you know, Rod allegedly agreed with that. Blagojevich denies that and denies that ever happened. But, you know, Monk had some pretty specific memories about it, described, you know, Rezko actually pulling out an easel at one point, right, and drawing some of this stuff up. He remembered that they were at the Beverly Hilton in California, you know, for one of these meetings. So he had some specific memories about it.
Jeff Cohn's my guest, investigative reporter over at the Chicago Tribune, wrote a piece today about the Blagojevich sentence and what you need to know, the differences between truth and myth when it comes to this. He's also the co-author of Golden, How Rod Blagojevich Talked Himself Out of the Governor's Office and Into Prison. Take a quick break, continue with Jeff Cohn right after. So stay with us. Extension 720 rolling along here at 720 WGN. I'm Justin Kaufman. Jeff Cohen's in studio. Jeff, of course, the co-author of Golden, How Rod Blagojevich Talked Himself Out of the Governor's Office and Into Prison, along with his cohort John Chase. Both, Jeff is a great investigative reporter at the Chicago Tribune. Is John still with the Trib?
He's with the BGA.
The BGA, right. But another great reporter as well. You guys covered the trial, and you wrote a piece today kind of separating myth and the truth when it comes to Blagojevich's conviction. You know, and you ask all these questions, you kind of go into it. The next question is really just about playing politics. And we hear this all the time. Trump kind of talked about this too. You know, what he's guilty of is this is what politicians do. Not me, but politicians do this. Is that part of this? I mean, that was kind of his argument, that this is just what politics is, horse trading and going back and forth.
Yeah, and you know, in Chicago, you're probably not wrong. I mean, that is kind of the sport around here. It's hard to argue that that's not true. And we've seen many, you know, public corruption cases since Rod Blagojevich. That's exactly right. But that goes back probably to the Madigan point. I mean, prosecutors certainly said, you know, that they could see where maybe that could be a fake out. That whole idea was that U.S. senators at the time did not want Jesse Jackson Jr. to be in the U.S. Senate.
Why? What was it? They just didn't like him?
They just didn't like him. Yeah, I think they thought he was a little bit
unpredictable. Because he was a rising star at that time.
He was a rising star at that time. But, you know, the Harry Reids of the world, I think, were interested at that time in not having him in, you know, for whatever their reasons were. And, of course, he wound up having his own,
right,
you know, criminal problems.
But he was a central figure in this case because he was the one that Blagojevich wanted to trade with and actually listened, and right, that's where his brother went to talk with his crew and the whole bit.
Yeah, so some representatives of Jesse Jackson Jr. came to the Blagojevich camp and said,
how about us?
Through the brother, actually, it's a funny story. They were talking about, you know, what could they offer in terms of campaign contributions to the Blagojeviches, and one of their reps held up, you know, one finger on one hand and five in the other, which Robert Blagojevich took as $1.5 million. Turns out the guy meant six, so they kind of...
He meant
undersold themselves,
oh
yeah, but, you know, whatever. So you leave 4.5 on the table. But there at the end, again, when, you know, Rod sends his brother to those guys at the time where he was telling the jury that he was really wanting to do the Madigan deal, you know, that looks a little bit different to everybody's eyes.
It is interesting because you feel, and I'll have texters that'll text in and they'll say, come on, you know, everybody does this. He just got caught. And that's the question, I think, that is at the central part of how long this sentence was. This is, feels like, come on, all right. So, you know what? He was horse trading and he got caught doing it. He should have got a slap on the wrist as opposed to 15 years in jail.
Well, and the key becomes, what do we tolerate as far as people using their public office to self-deal and enrich themselves? I mean, we've seen cases recently among, you know, aldermen going back over the last several years, where it seems like, you know, they'll do something like set up a zoning situation for a developer and they'll, you know, pocket just a few $1,000s and they'll wind up over 219 South Dearborn, just like Rod Blagojevich did. We're talking about much bigger sums with Rod. And I'm not saying, you know, I think the sentence is fair or not, you know, for me personally, but that's just kind of the perspective to remember, because when Donald Trump is on Air Force One and just says, you know, I think he's been treated unfairly, that sets off all kinds of water cooler talk, you know, across the city as far as, well, you know, is it fair or not? And you're right, it's hard to remember some of the details of what was.
For you as a reporter who covered this and then wrote the book on it and everything about it, do you agree with the president when he says, I think he was treated unfairly?
You know, part of what we wanted to do with the book, for example, was to look at the Blagojevich argument of play all the tapes. You remember that from his defense. He was, you know, he gave press conferences saying, if only everybody could hear all the tapes, I think that, you know, they would see a different side of this. So, you know, myself and John Chase, when we prepared this book, you know, part of it was to put it on library shelves in Illinois, set it aside for the kids of the future when they had to do a book report or whatever on Ron Blagojevich, you know. You know, God help them, that there would be some kind of a chronicling by journalists who were here at the time where people could say, who was this guy? What was this about? So we sought to get all of the tapes, even the ones that were not released publicly. And we did that. And we went through them. We went through, you know, hundreds of recordings.
Does his argument hold up? Play all the tapes?
Well, we did not find a home run for Rod Blagojevich. I think the strategy of that was that they wanted the jury to hear many dozens of tapes of Rod Blagojevich not shaking people down for campaign contributions, not self-dealing for the Senate seat. But the judge actually said, you know, Mr. Blagojevich's lawyers, you realize that you cannot, you know, argue that there were 72 times your client went into the bank and didn't rob it. Only the 73rd time. So I think that's, you know, a decent argument.
Okay, so at the end of the day, and I think it's interesting because the president, of course, has had his own struggles with the Justice Department, the FBI, and a lot of that went again. And regardless, let's just put the special prosecution aside with Russia. You also see a lot of proposed investigations into him trying to profit off of his office. There are similar storylines than what we see what happened to Rod Blagojevich. Do you think that plays a role in why the president is interested in this case?
I think it does. And you have to remember that Trump knows Rod Blagojevich. He was on The Apprentice, the show. And I think he probably sees a lot of himself in Blagojevich. Some of the, you know, to be honest, style over substance or the showmanship. The media manipulation that goes on. I think, you know, Rod Blagojevich is a character that Trump probably gets. And the fact that Patty's been out there flattering him, I think, you know, that's, is Trump immune to flattery? I don't think so.
No. And it is interesting, too, because Blagojevich did a Trump-like experience when he was on trial. He was on Letterman. He wanted to talk for himself. He was always trying to get a microphone to talk. He seemed to almost do the Trump playbook before Trump did it himself.
Yeah, it's kind of a primitive version of the Trump messaging system. At the time, I mean, Twitter was obviously existed, but it wasn't kind of the machine that it is now that kind of drives the political conversation in America. So if you can imagine the Rod Blagojevich case at the time, if it were now,
he would just be on Twitter all the time.
Right.
Yeah.
So his defense strategy was, let's turn this guy into a celebrity. They were thinking about R. Kelly and people like that. You know, are there ways to, it's a higher standard sort of to get a conviction of a celebrity. So they pushed him out there. And they also felt like so much of the case was about what was going on in Rod's head and his intent when he was on these calls, that who better to explain what he meant than Rod Blagojevich. So they threw him out there on all the late night TV shows. they thought he was likable enough and funny that people, you know, the potential juror pool would like him, and that would be a way to get their side of it out. And it's Trump now just, you know, talks directly to us every morning when you check your phone.
Well, if you want to go back into history, if you've got a book report or something to do, you can check out the book Golden, How Rod Blagojevich Talked Himself Out of the Governor's Office and into Prison. One of the co-writers is here, Jeff Cohen. He's an investigative reporter from the Trib. Wrote about sort of sorting truth from myth today in the Chicago Tribune. Jeff, great to see you. Thanks for coming and setting the record.
It's Friday night. People could do it.
It's business time. It's business. It's business time.
For the download on Chicago Business, sponsored by Signature Bank. I'm Justin Kaufman. Let's talk tonight about how startups are trying to improve the medical community, in particular breast cancer. Chicago-based Paragon Biosciences has invested over $500 million in startups over the past couple months, trying to develop and disrupt a medical technology industry that can be stuck in its old ways. Paragon just announced the launch of a new company called Clarity Imaging, which is developing a new breast cancer diagnosis system using artificial intelligence. How does it work, and how do you innovate and develop technology in the medical field? Paragon's president and COO, Jim Robinson, here to discuss. Jim, thanks for being here.
Justin, thanks for having me. I appreciate it.
Let's first talk about Clarity. Why invest in this company? What is it about this new system that we should be paying attention to?
Well, in terms of investing, it's really our mission. So if you think about Paragon, what we do is we invest, build, and advise companies. Our focus is in the biopharmaceutical space, artificial intelligence space, as well as gene and cell therapy space. So this fit perfectly within our mission and the types of companies we want to invest in. It's also exciting because Clarity Imaging, now we're launching the first ever FDA-cleared artificial intelligence-enabled solution for breast cancer diagnosis, which is, as you know, is an important field for everyone to be focusing on in terms of improving outcomes, including starting with the diagnosis all the way through treatment.
It's amazing to me because you'll always just, as a layman, you talk all the time about how we can improve when we see, especially when it comes to breast cancer, how it's being diagnosed, how it's being treated. But you always kind of scratch your head about why the medical community hasn't gone further, or why there isn't more research, why we are still stuck in some of the old ways in which we deal with breast cancer. So it does feel like artificial intelligence might be not just the fun thing that you play around with when it's video games, but this could be possibly something that could be used by the medical community.
Oh, I agree with you completely. And you think about what we can do now with Clarity Imaging and the Quantech solution specifically. You know, we have the ability to help radiologists essentially see more than they can with their naked eye. When you think about artificial intelligence, it's about enabling a better outcome. And in this case, it's about enabling a better healthcare outcome. And diagnosis is so important. If you think about the moment you might think or you might hear you have cancer, everything that goes through your head at that point is really profound in terms of what you are thinking about your future. So for Quantex, we have the ability to basically improve
is the technology.
The technology itself has the ability to really improve. When you think about missing breast cancers, we have the ability to help radiologists about 40% of the time ensure we don't miss a breast cancer on the diagnosis, and overall 20% improvement in diagnosis. So you think about, if you hear you might have cancer, but you can actually get a definitive diagnosis earlier in the treatment paradigm, mm-hmm. the better off you're going to be, whether it's actually taking course to be treated. Or, very importantly to know, 75% of the time that a patient is sent on to have a biopsy, that biopsy comes back negative. So if you can actually give a patient a higher level of confidence that what we're looking at is probably benign or non-cancerous, and they have that sense of confidence, think about a mother, a wife, a sister, knowing that I'm probably okay. So for us, it's about how do we use artificial intelligence to help improve the outcome, whether it's a diagnosis or whether it's hopefully in the future for treatment.
It's very important to say FDA cleared, because that seems to be the challenge when it comes to biosciences and that realm and the medical community, because medical sciences community, because there's a lot of technology and it's moving at a fast rate, but until you get the government to say yes, we want to do that's cleared, you really can't go anywhere.
Yeah, and I think the good news is the FDA is evolving rapidly. You know, if you look at what's been happening, especially in oncology, the FDA is the standard bearer of what excellent looks like across the world, in my mind. And if you look at their ability to continue to evolve with technology, they're really, really keeping pace with what's happening, including in the biopharmaceutical space as well as the diagnostic space. So overall, the FDA is keeping pace, and we're really pleased to see that there are significant advances over especially the last 5 years in and treatment of various cancers.
What is the challenge? Is it getting hospitals and doctors to embrace this technology, to take on a new product or a new technology? What is the challenge when it comes to trying to get Quantix worldwide?
Oh, in terms of getting Quantix out, it's really about gaining more experience. So, you know, we are in the midst of the launch right now. Part of the launch phase of anything is a feedback. So the good news is we're getting solid feedback from our users. There's a tremendous amount of excitement about the utility of the Quantix software solution. Radiologists need this. That's basically the verbatims coming back. It allows them to be able to have a much better chance of diagnosing very early on. And that's an important point, is really diagnosing early on and being able to
use
the software.
But is it cost effective for hospitals and doctors? Are they like, no, this is too expensive, so I'm not going to, we'll leave this one out. Like, why wouldn't a doctor right away say, oh, I want in on this?
Great question. So in terms of cost effectiveness, as we just mentioned, if you think about how some of the diagnosis will go, is you move from the MRI breast image to then a biopsy. So if you think about, number one, avoiding the stress of the biopsy as well as avoiding the cost of the biopsy, there could be a related cost savings. The more and more you see the adoption of this type of solution, in our example for breast MRI. So if you can basically have a much more definitive diagnosis without having to go to the next step,
that's great. Yeah.
You actually do save money and improve outcomes.
When you think about it and you say it that way, and I think across the board when it comes to the different ways that we have diagnosed and gone at cancer, it seems like that would be the future. The fact that you can make it less intrusive, because anyone who has gone through a biopsy, especially when it comes to breast cancer, it's like another surgery. That seems to be the future, being able to use technology to avoid these going under the knife procedures just for diagnosis or just to find out what's happening.
I agree. If you look at the trend over the last decade, it's really about precision medicine. It's about really developing a biomarker. When you think about drug development, let's make sure we have the biomarker identified, that we can actually do a better job of identifying who might respond to therapy or who is the best responder to therapy. What that does is gives you a much higher chance in terms of understanding the types of patients who are going to have the greatest outcome and the probability of success being there even before you actually start to treat them. It's the same promise when you think about artificial intelligence in terms of improving the diagnosis, in this case, breast cancer. Being able to do that earlier on gives you a much better sense of what the treatment paradigm is going to look like over the short and long term. And that's the hope that we're unlocking with Quantix at this point now, as really early as possible, understanding the diagnosis so you can understand the treatment paradigm in the short and the long term.
You know, I think about this, and I was just thinking about this with you in your last answer, but just this concept, we saw it kind of play out in the political arena where candidate Joe Biden said, you know, if I get elected, I'm going to cure cancer. And everyone jumped on him. They jumped on him saying, oh, this laugh. You know how you can't do that. But what he's really saying is that he would make it a priority to fund research or to put more taxpayer dollars towards fixing what the scourge that affects all humankind. Do you feel that the government is doing enough when it comes to innovating and finding new ways to detect and, at the end of the day, cure cancer? Or is it going to have to come from the private sector, from the commercial areas and the startups that you're investing?
Well, that's a great question. So I look at it from a standpoint of the entire ecosystem. So if you think of the ecosystem, it includes government funding, especially at the NIH, where tremendous science takes place every single day. When you think about funding, it's also at the academic institutions, which Chicago is very proud to have some of the best in the world. In addition to that, it also takes industry. It takes large and small biopharmaceutical companies, and it takes investors that are willing to invest in some cases, a difficult investment given the fact that most drugs fail. So, yeah, absolutely. I think the government is absolutely committed to, number one, oncology in this example, but they're committed to funding research, especially basic research that's so important to unlock the mystery behind disease and then move that along into academic centers as well as in the private sector to make sure it can actually really be invested in to then bring it into the market. Any one of those links in the chain break along the way, we will see a significant slowdown in drug discovery, drug development, and ultimately getting those drugs into patients that need them. So it's a delicate ecosystem. Everyone plays a role. And I do think the government's doing quite a bit, especially if you look at NIH as being, if you will, the tip of the spear in terms of being able to drive success in drug discovery.
I think about not too long ago, I feel like, Pete, it was maybe a couple of years ago, we talked about the medical campus and creating a medical district or neighborhood over on the west side with UIC and Rush and all the hospitals coming together. When I think of Chicago being a leader in the tech industry, rarely do you think about the medical tech industry. You're thinking about more, when you say AI, you're thinking about we're going to have driverless cars in a year or two. But because of that push by the different hospital systems and because of the University of Chicago and Northwestern, who just got named one of the best hospitals in the country, Chicago is a great place for medical startups because there are so many different hospitals working in this area.
Unquestionably. I'm a homer. You know, I grew up in the Chicago area, so I'm obviously a little bit biased, but I've lived in New Jersey for 6 years, lived in Boston as well. I think the environment in Chicago is an amazing environment for biopharma, for technology, for medical technology. I was one of the founding members of Matter, which is right over here in the Merchandise Mart, and along with Jeff Aronin, who actually is the founder of Paragon, we were, you know, two of the folks early on that felt, hey, if we can really harness the value proposition of Chicago and bring a community together, we not only can bring more innovation in the Chicago area, but unleash that innovation across the world. So if you think about the success of Matter as an example, there have been 220 companies that have been spun out of Matter, innovated there and spun out. Over $1 billion of investment have gone into those 200 plus startup companies. So there's a tremendous amount of opportunity in Chicago. As you mentioned, we have some of the best academic research centers in the world here, within walking distance of one another in some cases. There's a very collegial environment. We have some of the best biotech and pharma companies in the world right here. And we've got folks that are really interested in investing in Chicago to make sure it's a thriving biopharmaceutical and med tech environment.
Jim Robinson is the CEO and president of Paragon Biosciences, and they just announced the launch of the new company, Clarity Imaging, using artificial intelligence to develop a new breast cancer diagnosis system. Jim, thanks for coming in, being my guest, and Download Chicago Business, and continue the great work.
Thanks, Justin.
Extension 720 here, 720 WGN, 312-981-7200, the phone number. Beautiful night as the sun sets on another beautiful week here in Chicago. We've been talking about this, Pete, that, it felt like at the beginning of I don't know, the summer, this was going to be one of the worst summers of all time. So much rain. Then it became so hot, so hot. Now, I just feel like for the last maybe 2 weeks now, beautiful. And maybe this is, maybe somewhere along the line, I'm convinced, and I don't have any science or any data to back this up, but I'm convinced somewhere along the line, someone didn't carry the one, and our calendar changed.
Yeah, summer's moving.
So everyone will say climate change, and there's data to back that up. But I say, somewhere along the line, there was a leap year that we did not pay attention to, lost like 3 weeks.
Yep.
So May is actually April, June is May, July is June, August, July, September.
Yeah.
I keep going.
Yeah.
Yeah, right?
I agree.
I should get some funding for this story. Should get some research grant.
Why not?
Find out exactly where we didn't carry the one. And then I go on the circuit and get a real weather app. That would be Justin Kaufman's weather app. And it would say, it was like an almanac. So instead of looking at the weather for August 9th, I'd be looking at the weather for September 9th. And then reapplying it.
Yeah. Well, whenever I'm on the train and there's an ad, and it's always for the, Northwestern is conducting a research for people that have smoked from 18 to 20. And I always want, I'm dying to do one of those. Like, I want, because they're like, compensate, we'll give you up to $10,000.
Yeah. I saw, our buddy Richard Streetman, who did one of the Chicago neighborhood tours. He was on, he was great. I remember seeing him on Facebook not too long ago where he had a bunch of wires connected to his head and his nose. And he's like, I signed up for the sleep study. So he was like, he was down at the University of Chicago.
Yeah.
Like, he actually answered one of those ads.
Right. Yeah,
he
I always see those ads in the subway.
He's asking whatever happened to that. And Richard, why'd you fall asleep in the middle of that sentence? Oh, they altered something. But I'm sure they gave you a voucher for the cafeteria, so that's good.
I always think that they're like, are they targeting me? Like, yeah, this guy's taking the subway. He must need an extra 10 grand. He'll probably do it.
He'll do it. Yeah, exactly. Mm-hmm. I don't know what that is. Sounded like a
door.
Maybe I touched one of the Rokan hotkeys.
Oh.
Maybe I did. Let me try one here. No, it's not working, so like, it must not have been us.
Phantom.
Something else. Yep, got it. It's doing it again. It was weird. Yeah, it's coming from the hotkey, so I just cut
it. Oh, yeah.
Did you get it?
But it's weird because like I put the hotkey, it's like down on my board.
Yeah, weird. All right. Just shut it off. How about that? Keeps coming back on. That's weird.
Well, I'm going to alert the... Ernie was in here talking softball. Maybe I'll see if he could...
That is the strangest thing ever because it... And
it's off.
Technical. It's off, but it keeps turning itself back on. I brought it all the way down. We're going to start from scratch.
Somebody in another room.
You know what it is?
Sabotaging you?
Miriam Sob, who has her one woman show. She's coming on to talk about it from Second City. She could possibly be in the green room. She has radio experience.
Yeah.
And she could have routed into a different board and start playing sound effects.
A little booby trap. Yeah.
312-981-7200 is the phone number. Coming up, Marion Sobe's going to join us. Headscarf Above Water is her one-woman show she's doing in Judy's Beat Lounge, which is one of the stages at Second City. Judy Fabchance, by the way, who is a friend of ours who unfortunately succumbed to cancer a couple years back, but they named the theater after her, one of the stages there. And but that's awesome that you know we get to her memory continues to live on through Second City shows and people coming through, so it's great that she's in Judy's studio. That's awesome. So Miriam, of course, is doing a one-woman show. She'll be here coming up after the news at 8:30. Muslim American woman. I've worked with her and before. She's wonderful, but she's doing this one-woman show about life as a Muslim American woman. And all the stereotypes, both on sort of how the Muslim community treats women, but also how people look at her, you know, other people who aren't Muslim. So have that comedic conversation coming up. And Kim Schultz is her director as well, has a background as well as a refugee advocate. So she'll be in studio, another comedian and director. So that's coming up here at 8:30. And the 9 o'clock hour, Brandon Hendrickson, we're going up to the Barbell Compound. Up on North Avondale, and we've been talking about this for a couple days now. I don't even know how to say it. He told us in the interview it's like the physique, like it was a body physique category. Was that what it was? It was like a different, it was a little bit peak different, like the full on, I'm the biggest guy in the room and I got the biggest muscles, I'm Mr. Olympia, like, that's one category. And then you have like a body physique category, which is the same thing, but you just look. It's amazing to see these guys because they don't do the speedos, right? The speedos will be for the main competitors. The body physique guys do board shorts. So right away, that's nice. And they have a lot of is like their waist size. Their waist size, it's almost like a V going down.
Yeah.
Their waist size is really small and it's just all muscle up the top. I'm telling you.
Yeah.
So anyway, he was gracious enough to let us up to do the interview in his gym. As he gets ready for defending his title, he is Mr. Olympia 2018.
How does he? I wonder how he finds a pair of jeans.
Right,
because he's probably like a 24 waist.
Yeah, right.
But his like thighs are like 50. You know, he can never find a pair of jeans.
He's like the Hulk.
You know, yeah,
he's like ripped on the edges, kind of thing.
Yeah,
you're absolutely right. How do you find the jeans?
I don't think you're going in. You're not buying off the rack.
We already went up there and talked to him, and that's one question I wish I would have asked. What do you do with jeans? And one final question, Brandon. What about jeans? What are you thinking about? Is there a certain style? Is there a bodybuilder jean?
Loose fit.
Loose fit. But it can't even be loose fit.
Or classic fit.
No, it's got to be even, I don't know what's different than loose fit, like baggy. These thighs are huge.
Yeah. I think he's going like athleisure.
Yeah,
something with
sweatpants.
More of a sweatpants.
He's going
look.
Designer sweatpants.
Yeah.
So he's got those sweatpants that you can both work out in and go to the nightclub in.
Yeah.
Right? Go hit a fancy dinner with your designer sweatpants. There was a one story a while back where a guy got stopped outside a club, and they said, you're not wearing appropriate clothing. Yeah. And there's one of those places in the River North
Pizza
or whatever.
Parlor
stupid.
Or whatever.
Yeah. And then the story afterwards was that the pants he was wearing were designer sweatpants, and the guy's like, these are $250. Yeah. That was my favorite part. The bouncer's like, those are sweatpants.
My sweatpants are worth more than your suit, pal.
Yeah. Yeah.
Step
that's
aside.
Thank you. I'll wear sweatpants. $250 sweatpants. That's the first question I had was, who pays $250 for sweatpants?
Someone who can afford
Yeah. Bodybuilder, I guess, Mr. Olympia. All right, coming up, Marion Sob, Kim Schultz. Stay with us. Thanks, David. 312-981-7200 is our phone number. The show, extension 720 here on 720 WGN. I'm Justin Kaufman. Coming up at 9 o'clock, Brandon Hendrickson, bodybuilder here in Chicago. Chicago kid, grew up here, who is Mr. Olympia. He is going to defend his title coming up here in 2019 in September in Las Vegas. But he was gracious enough to open up his gym doors, and we had a chance to go up and talk with him about what exactly is the motivation to be the muscliest person in America. I don't even know how to explain it. I know it's radio, but you know what I'm talking about. If you see Arnold Schwarzenegger and you know how he looked in the 70s and 80s, but just muscles everywhere. I mean, his fingers were muscles. There were so many muscles from this kid. I'm looking forward to hearing that coming up in the 9 o'clock hour. An old friend of mine is in studio now, Marion. So Marion is a broadcaster here in Chicago, but she's well known as well as a comedian, an actress, writer. And she has a new show at Second City called Headscarf Above Water, which is tomorrow night, the final show. It's directed by Kim Schultz, who also has a long career in improv and comedy and also a refugee advocate. And we're going to talk more about that. But first off, pleasure to have you in studio. Mariam Sob, good to see you.
Thank you
it's
so much.
It's been a long time.
Yeah, it has been a long
When's
time.
When's the last time we saw each other? I feel like it's been at least 5 years.
Yeah, I was going to say about 5 years.
You look great. Good to
so
see you.
So do you. But you know what? We stalk each other online.
That's
so.
Right.
Time has not gone by.
Like everything, it feels like Instagram sort of keeps us in each other's lives. This show, and I remember you going through Second City and the conservatory and all to make your way into theater. You've been continuing to do that. What is this show, Headscarf Above Water? Why go back to Second City?
I think it's a culmination of just all these years of trying to put stuff together and learn and just finally, I mean, I don't know how else to explain it, but just to put my story out there. So you go through these programs, you have ensemble work with other people, but your voice isn't there, right? You have to work and collaborate and cooperate. And sometimes you're like, I want it to be about me. So this is my chance to showcase my story and what I'm about. I think there's a lot of misunderstanding surrounding me. I'm not saying I'm some famous celebrity that people know who I am and they're talking about me. But in general, in my life, I found that there's just so many different sides that have put this idea of who you are, and I wanted to share my story.
And there's not too many places in comedy, especially here in Chicago, where the Muslim American experience is on stage. And you know, I think that you'll see tours that come through and other people who might be stand-ups in other places. But and a lot of times it's guys, you know, sort of on a tour. But to be a Muslim American woman, to tell your story, it is a unique story, one that is not heard in this city.
Yeah, I think the uniqueness of it hopefully will get people interested. and that's also kind of why I wanted to share my story, is because people might see me and be like, oh, is that some Arab woman or whatever? And I'm like, you don't really know my background. Or they'll be like, did you convert? Did your husband force you to convert? I'm like, no, I'm actually just an American woman who happens to wear a scarf on her head. So I don't know.
Yeah. Kim, how'd you get involved in this project?
A good friend of ours put us in touch with each other, knowing that I was a director and working with refugee community and Muslim community as an advocate and a friend. And so we met and decided to start working together.
Your background, and we could do a whole hour on your background, because you have spent time in improv and comedy, and you came to it that way. But you, in developing a show, you spent some time in the Middle East and in Iraq and other places, and really was able to come back and put a show on off-Broadway and really sort of become an advocate because of what you learned and the experiences you had, particularly in Iraq.
Yeah, I'm primarily an actor and a writer, comedian and storyteller, and was invited under those auspices to go to the Middle East and meet with Iraqi refugees about 10 years ago. And we're in Jordan, Lebanon, and Syria. And they wanted somebody who had comic sensibilities to be able to share these stories to an American audience that I had really heard none of them at that point 10 years ago. So I was very honored, and I kind of fell into the refugee advocacy, and that turned into interfaith work for me, because a lot of times it is connected to religious bigotry, yeah, and anti-Muslim phobias. And so so that kind of is the world that I'm in now, while still keeping my comic sensibility. So you can imagine meeting Miriam, what a find she was, because it is a rare thing to have a hijabi, a headscarf-wearing Muslim-American comedian, female comedian, and who's willing to share her story and do so vulnerably and also, obviously, comedically.
Yeah, right.
So we decided to start working on Headscarf Above Water together.
The show, which is at Second City in Judy's Beat Lounge, is tomorrow night. That's the final show. It's been a two-week run. Miriam, what do you learn from show to show? When you're putting together the show and you do it the first time and you have reactions from jokes and other sort of things that you learn about backstage and pacing and tempo,
yeah,
how do you apply what you learned last week in such a short run to what you're doing this week?
Well, I think definitely it helps that I have a director to whip me into shape and be like, next time, don't forget that joke.
She skipped a couple of my favorite jokes and I said, don't do that.
Yeah. It's going
to
happen.
Yeah, I mean, when you're in the moment, sometimes you're trying to get through it. And for me, coming from the broadcasting background where I have to be on time specifically, I was like, what time is it? You know, I didn't have my watch and I need to hit these spots. And I kept thinking, like, am I too short? Am I too long? So this time I'm going to take my time, relax, think more about the content that I want to put out, and think about the parts where people got the laughs, where I got the laughs from folks, and like maybe just kind of punch it up a little bit.
And what I told her too is not to be afraid of those other moments, because you can't have a show called Headscarf Above Water in 2019 in the country that we live in, the political system that we're living under, and not discuss what that means to wear a headscarf, yeah, underwater, above water.
There are some waterproof ones.
I do that often.
Miriam, that's a great point. I mean, you have to kind of balance your story and the jokes that you tell with the expectations of what people are coming to see. Mm-hmm. When you know, and it's a funny take on the title, Headscarf Above Water, but you come out, you've got the hijab on, you're a Muslim American woman who is telling your story. There are expectations of what an audience expects to see.
Yeah, I think it depends on the audience. So for me, I'm always more worried about the Muslim community than I am about regular people. Well, they are regular people too. But I mean, my people, the Muslim community, they can be quite cynical or judgmental, especially if you're coming out in a scarf. They're like, you're representing the community. You're representing us. We need you to be like pure and like nothing sleazy. You know, they get worried about that. And I'm like, well, sorry, I'm just going to say what I want to say. And so for me, over the years, I've had to kind of let go of worrying about what they think and say, this is my story to tell. These are my experiences. And maybe you can learn something from my life and realize that maybe you're just judging me in the wrong way.
That is just something I didn't even think about, that the relationship with the audience differs and what the background of the audience is. Do you find yourself having more connection with a Muslim audience or with an audience that is non-Muslim that's coming to celebrate your ethnicity?
I think it's a mix. I think, it's a mix. But I think I personally feel like I connect with the mainstream audience, and that's who I'm kind of trying to target towards, because they don't know my story and my background. The Muslim community, they get some of my jokes, but I had that reminds me of like when we were writing some of the stuff, it was too insider and I had to like flush it out and like, oh, I have to make this for everybody.
And I think the show really does speak to both a Muslim and a non-Muslim audience very in a very, I think, special way, because more often than not, it'll be only for, you know, non-Muslim audiences, you know.
Right,
but
right.
I think there is something in this show for people of all religions and no religions.
Yeah, and I think I also try to speak to the fact of like when you're from a mixed background and there's two different sides to you and you don't know where you fit in. So I think some people can relate to that, whether you come from a similar background or not, just like, where do I fit in society in the times that we live in? Like, I don't see myself So I'm just trying to navigate that and let people know, you know, you're not alone. I feel the same way.
Miriam Sobe is here along with Kim Schultz. Kim is the director of Miriam's one-woman show, Headscarf Above Water, which is at Second City at Judy's Beat Lounge tomorrow night. The show is at 7?
9.
It's later. Oh, look at you. You're keeping those late night hours.
Well, we gotta watch what we say. 9 o'clock.
9 o'clock hour. 9 o'clock hour at Judy's Beat Lounge, which is on the second floor at Second City at Piper's Alley. All right, we'll take a quick break. Come back. We'll continue the conversation with Miriam Kim here on Extension 720. Stay with us. Extension 720 rolling along till 10 o'clock tonight here on 720 WGN. I'm Justin Coffin. Headscarf Above Water is the one-woman show. Miriam Sobe, you may know that name. She's a broadcaster here in Chicago. Some random station. I won't really get into it. Kim Schultz is her director as Miriam is on stage at Second City's Judy's Beat Lounge, which is on the second floor there, the complex that they have in Piper's Alley. You mentioned right before the break, Miriam, just this concept of, you know, trying to, you know, when you try to identify with audiences and trying to find your space, how difficult is that in comedy, being a Muslim American woman who wears a headscarf, to fit in with a pretty white dude dominated comedy world here in Chicago? I mean, it is, Second City has done a lot to diversify itself over time, but it still is the majority mainstream experience is a white man experience.
Mm-hmm. I mean, I think times have certainly changed. Like when I started 10 years ago taking improv and doing all that stuff, I definitely felt out of place. But I think now, 10 years later, things have taken a dramatic turn. People want this fresh new perspective and different voices and diversity, that buzzword. So I feel that now it was just the perfect timing, and it's more well received than if I had tried to do this 10 years ago.
Mm-hmm. Kim, how do you deal with that, like as a director, to make sure that Miriam's voice is pure to her and not affected by the way that mainstream culture would consume or push her in one direction or the other?
I think my job always, whether it's my own material or someone else's, is to help hone their voice so that it is her being truthful from her voice and her experience, and not really worried about anything else. I mean, like I said earlier, I think this show really speaks to different types of audiences, and I think that is Miriam and her writing and how it connects with people.
You know, and just based on some of your comedy, and you have it on your website, but I've also seen some of you. You are not shy at poking fun at the Muslim experience. Mm-hmm. That's a big part. So, how do Muslim audiences react to that? Like, I was thinking about the video that's on your site about the birds and the bees. You know, this
which
concept,
you get a sample of in the
right,
show,
right? But
too.
I would assume, but this idea of dealing with taboo or even dealing with sex and mm-hmm. and issues that may be taboo in the Muslim community, how are audiences responding to you being more free with that sort of joke as opposed to maybe the community is?
I think people actually enjoy it. I mean, so far I've only gotten positive feedback. There are a few people that'll be like, oh my gosh, why are you saying this? You're a naughty woman, you know, but like, who cares?
Yeah, it's so funny. I mean, the stuff about what the Muslim person would not say about sex or about how babies are formed. I mean, it's so
yeah.
funny. And you can see the audiences recognizing the truth of it.
Right. And I try to compare it to, like, it's not just the Muslim community. Anyone who's super conservative, any faith background, they have the same exact hang-ups. And so that's the funny part is, like, we always look to someone else like, oh, those Muslims are so conservative. I'm like, yeah, but I can tell you the same thing about my ultra-conservative Christian friends who have had the same sort of childhood
growing up.
Right,
right. And also, you know, you have to, I would assume that you would, you know, you obviously are taking on stereotypes, Muslim stereotypes, but at the same time, you know, there is this Muslim stereotype that we have, especially when it comes to headscarves and what we think of, I guess, the sort of mainstream approach to that.
Mm-hmm.
Is that played out in the show? Do you kind of try to tear that down, this idea of what people think of? You kind of made joke of it at the beginning just about, you know, when they see a woman with a headscarf on, you know, I don't know if they're scared, but they're like, oh, that's different, and they're unique.
Yeah.
So you kind of play off of that fear or that not necessarily knowing what that means.
Yeah, I mean, for sure, the whole show deals with it, and it's funny because I think I was trying to shy away from it, and Kim was like, "This is the title of the show. You need to talk about it."
Yeah.
And it's been such a therapeutic like release to finally be able to just talk about it and make fun of it and make fun of the things that people have said to me over the years, even in this industry, you know, like, yeah, maybe we won't talk about that.
And what it is to wear a headscarf today and and what those experiences are. And she makes jokes of it, like not she offers to take off her headscarf as a joke to make people comfortable because of how she shares how she first put on her headscarf. So there's these light humor humorous moments that
where do you think that comes from? Why do we have a any sort of hang up over women wearing headscarves? Is it is it just about the stereotype?
I think so. I mean, it's I don't even know where it comes from. I mean, it's just something like I grew up, like I remember as a child seeing people say things to my mom when we'd be out, you know, calling her a terrorist, telling her to go back to her country, and she's American. I mean, she converted to Islam in college on her own.
Lines from the show.
Yeah, exactly. So it's just like, it's for me, it's just something that I grew up witnessing around me and not understanding why this was happening or where it came from. But I think there's just so much misunderstanding, and possibly some of it came from the immigrant Muslim community that came to the United States and didn't really want to, I don't want to say assimilate, but there was maybe some sort of...
didn't want to give up their cultural ideals.
Right, and so they didn't know how to like interact with people, and there's different factions. Some people are like, no, we need to just like be with our community and make sure that our kids aren't going to, you know, start doing sex and drugs and doing all this stuff, and so we got to, you know, kind of keep insulated. And now I'm losing my train of thought.
No, but you're right. That maybe that has something to do with the fact it's on both sides, where there wasn't a lot of intermingling, if you will, because of the cultural, obviously the cultural differences. But because of that, here we are with a stereotype of not really knowing each other.
Yeah. We know now that, you know, what we're facing today is just a fear, misinformation, and hatred bias towards brown, black people, regardless, Muslims, immigrants, refugees, all of this. So why does this happen? We can go back in time and, you know, list all the various historical reasons.
The headscarf play, it's just an interesting thought in that it is coding in this way, because if you're wearing a headscarf, you're probably Muslim. If you're Muslim, then that could mean a number of things, from the hate, from rhetoric that's been passed down from leaders and political factions in this country. So there is, I mean, there's not every single, you know, person who walks on the street has identifying markers like a headscarf. So there is automatically this idea that you're different just because of what you're wearing.
Right.
But I always like that you just kind of call it out for fashion.
It pretty much is a fashion statement.
Yeah, right?
I don't have much hair. But, you know, and I think one of the other reasons why there's so much misunderstanding is, like, in our mainstream media here in the United States, you don't see a Muslim woman with a headscarf. We're supposed to be like light years ahead of like all these other countries who have already done that. Europe, there are plenty of women with headscarves who are on television, and it's normal. And for some reason here, it just can't be done. It just cannot be done. It's never been done and never will be done. That those are the kinds of things that I've been told, and I don't understand it.
And you don't see it on stage either. And that's for actors playing other roles, and that's never, you never see that.
Right, and that's kind of why with this show, it's like now I get to put it in my hands. I'm in control, and I'm going to be out there in your face, okay?
I love it. You will dominate and take over the stages of Chicago. Then you get you on TV in front of everyone with your headscarf on,
exactly.
And you will change all the
norms.
I
need a Netflix special if anyone is listening.
Headscarf Above Water is the show. It's written and performed by Miriam Sobe and directed by Kim Schultz. They're both in studio tomorrow night, 9:00 at Judy's Beat Lounge at Second City, right there in Piper's Alley. Check
just
it out.
Just a few tickets left.
Great to meet you, Kim. Great to see you again.
Likewise.
Congrats on all your success, both on stage and on broadcast. And let's not wait 5 years to see each other again.
Thank you for having us.
Thanks for being here. Thank you, David. Extension 720 here on 720 WGN. Justin Kaufman, 312-981-7200 is the phone number. Coming up, I want to talk about my birthday. My birthday is coming up next week. Yeah. And I don't know. I've been having I want to celebrate my birthday. It's my 45th birthday, and I want to celebrate it in a way that I bring together a lot of friends, Pete, other people to come together. I was thinking about maybe getting a karaoke room, you know, something like that, some big kind of party. I'm already behind the eight ball. I mean, I'm way behind on this planning.
Well, why do you have to plan it?
But that's my point. I'm having a conundrum. The conundrum is, after talking with my wife about it, and this was over the last weekend, we were talking about, what if we went down to the Chinatown, to Sakura, which is a great karaoke place on Cermak, or what if we did this, or what if we had a party at home? It always turned out to be, well, who's going to pay for it? And Julie would always be like, well, you pay for it. And I'm like, what do you mean? Because she's like, it's $75 an hour or whatever. You know, what about everybody's, you know, drinks? Or if we have a party at home, we got to cater it. So any scenario in which I brought together a bunch of people, friends of mine, to celebrate my birthday and really use it as an excuse to just have a gathering of friends. Which we never get to do, is coupled with me having to pay for it.
No, on my birthday. No.
And it's not that I'm cheap and I'm like, oh, I don't want to. I'm just sort of like the principal. I'm like, hey, listen, it's my birthday. Like, I want to have a party, but I don't want to pay for anything.
Right.
But, like, that's not how adults do it.
Yes, they do.
No, I've asked a couple friends, and they're like, yeah, when you get to 45, that's why people don't have parties and stuff. Like, you end up, if I have a party and you invite you over, Pete, I'm going to have beer there. I'm going to have wine. I'm going to have food. I'm going to be the one who, like, sets all that stuff. I'm doing work on my birthday.
Well, I mean, I guess. But, you know, my wife's turned 40 this past July, and we went out. We went for a weekend to Detroit.
Yeah, that was great.
And she paid, for a couple of things on the trip. But, I mean, I paid. This was my idea. I'm going to pay for the hotel and, you know, a couple of nice dinners.
Right. Well, that's different. That's a destination kind of thing where you're going out. And it wasn't, like, it sounds like this was your idea. So it's like a birthday present that you're getting.
Right.
I'm in a situation where I am saying, you know what I want to do? I want to go do karaoke. And I want to go in a room. Okay, I need, I'm thinking like 15 people come with me. Let's have a really fun time. Okay, well, it costs money to do that.
Mm-hmm.
Got to go down there. So to me, I'm like, well, everyone else can pay for their own drinks. What am I paying for? Pete's Corona? You can figure it out, right? It's classic me. Like, no, it's a BYOB. Figure it out. If you want to go with a more than a well drink, go get it. It's your thing. You got a credit card. You figure it out.
Yeah, I guess.
But that's
my
point, or my wife's point, and from friends as well, my brother and others are like, yeah, man, that's just adult. That's adulting now. If you want to have that kind of party, it's more of like you're inviting your friends to come out. The expectation is that party will be free. So the expectation for you, if I say, hey, I give you a little invite, I'm like, Pete, Molly, come on down. I want you guys to come down to this place, and we're going to have a lot of fun. I can't be like, oh, yeah, no, it's also a $25 cover.
Yeah.
Can I get that up front, guys? Like, it just doesn't work. So I'm like, well, I guess I'm not doing anything.
But, I mean, yeah. I guess if it's your idea,
right.
If it's your, you know, this is
my idea,
you're coming up with this. It's not like your wife is saying, like,
right.
I'm going to throw Justin a party. I'm going to invite all his friends.
That's different.
Different. Yeah. Yeah. You're paying
I got to pay for it.
Yeah, you're on the hook.
And then it sours it for me. I don't know why. Again, it's not really about the money. It's just more about, why would I want to drop hundos on you guys? You know, then I'm like, nah.
You know, if you invite people who are your real friends, they'll kick in for it.
Yeah, but
I mean, if enough people go, what did the karaoke room is how much an hour?
12 to 15, $75 an hour.
$75, 12 to 15 people. That's not a lot of money.
It's not. But my wife said, there's no way in hell that at 45 years old, I can be like, David, hey, man. Listen,
no, you can't.
I want you to come down, but at the same time, I'm going to need $15 up front. It's uncouth. I can't do it.
And even in an instance like this, you're going to, if you invite people over to your house, say, people are going to bring stuff no matter what.
Yeah, right,
so you don't really have to, but
you have to
pretend like you're serving everybody.
Yeah.
You can't. You're not 22.
No, exactly. And
where
I gotta
everybody's got
to
chip in.
You don't have to.
You
don't have to serve everybody, even at your own house. You can just make it a buffet. Everybody brings some stuff,
I appreciate it. You're invited next time, David, because you got the right attitude. See, the other one of my friends who did, my wife included. Last time I had a birthday, I had a birthday party probably when I was 41, something around that time, and. Yeah, at the party, and I remember being kind of frustrated because I had to go to smoke and get barbecue, and I had to get the beer and all this kind of stuff. And at the end of the day, I'm like, I felt like I was throwing someone else a party. You know, someone came over.
What if you do this? You invite everybody to a restaurant, and you just say, hey, look, everybody's kicking in to pay the tab.
No.
No, I wish. He can't do it.
I had a little gathering a few years ago, and everybody came to a restaurant.
Mm-hmm.
And everybody kicked in and paid for their own food.
Yeah, all right.
You simply, you figure out, you get the tab, and
that's
you divide it by the number of people at the table. It's not that hard to do.
I know. I'm with you. I'm 100% with you.
No, for your birthday.
But I feel like the Zimmermans and the wives and things like that to tell me I can't.
It's your birthday.
Yeah, but I don't want to come across as I want to follow the guidelines to what it means to be a eloquent and sophisticated adult, 45-year-old. So I can't be like David Jennings up there being like, "Hey, I'm going to take out my calculator, split it 15 ways."
Yeah, arguments. Hey, I didn't have an app.
Yeah.
Maybe.
How many people were you looking at, David? You're like, who had the Amstel Light?
Maybe
that's a premium drink.
Maybe you question who your friends are.
That's why you don't think I'm doing that?
If they're a little difficult, you know.
You don't think that I'm doing that already? That was part of the problem. I'm like, before I even invited anybody, I'm like, well, screw all them. They're out. So that's where I'm at. All right, we'll take a break, and then Brandon Hendrickson will go up to the Chicago Barbell Compound to talk weightlifting, bodybuilding, and Mr. Olympia. Stay with us. Mr. Olympia is this is the go-to competition for weightlifters and bodybuilders in the country, in the world. And a kid right here in Chicago, Brandon Hendrickson, won last year. He's 2018's Mr. Olympia, and he's going to defend his title coming up here in September in 2019. We went up to Chicago Barbell Compound, which is up on the 6300 block of Avondale, North Avondale, right by Harlem, to talk with Brandon. It's a nondescript gym. You got a little key card to swipe in and swipe out, but you would never know that some of the best bodybuilders in the entire country are training right here in Chicago. Brandon Hendrickson was gracious enough to open up the doors at the gym for us to come talk about bodybuilding, about the competition, and about his life and why he chooses to do this. So let's take a listen. All right, up in the Northwest Side, Brandon Hendrickson, Mr. Olympia, reigning champ, just an amazing story for a Chicagoan. You're getting ready to defend the title, Mr. Olympia. But take us through, what's this year been like being a champion?
Well, first thing, I'll never get tired of hearing that. And thank you for this opportunity to be on the forefront of bodybuilding, of health and fitness, of positivity, being that guy from Chicago, giving everyone that started where I started an opportunity to be better. So I'm just happy to be that guy, be that leader. It's been a seven-year journey for me. I started in 2012.
Why did you start? What was it in 2012 that said, hey, I want to get into bodybuilding?
I was a little skinny kid, man. I got tired of being made fun of. People making fun of me in work, in school, and I just got tired of it. I wanted to be better. I wanted to progress. And I found an outlet, an avenue for me to do that, and that's the gym. And I started going to the gym and eating clean, staying consistent, and started seeing results, and I became addicted to the results.
There's one thing to say, hey, I'm a skinny kid and I want to get myself in shape. There's another to go to the extent that you have to become Mr. Olympia.
Yeah.
I mean, you're the new poster. You're on the poster for pumping iron. I mean, you're the new guy.
For sure.
So where do you get from I want to change who I am in 2012 to where you are now in 2019?
Yeah, so like I said, I just started going to the gym just because I wanted to be better. And, I saw an opportunity to get on stage, which is something I've always wanted to do. Since back in college, I was modeling for actually a black organization in college, and I got so used to the limelight and the looks being everyone looking at me, so I love that energy on stage. And I was able to I found a division called men's physique in bodybuilding where I had the opportunity to showcase my physique at that level. We're so used to seeing Arnold Schwarzenegger,
right,
the bigger guys,
right.
So men's physique is a division that started in 2012, which is when I started bodybuilding. I went to a show, I saw men's physique, and was immediately inspired.
So that's more about the overall package. That's about how you look, but it's also, it's different than the Speedo Arnold Schwarzenegger that we're used to.
Exactly.
It's a little different.
It's a little different, yeah. I mean, we're still on stage showcasing our physiques, our hard work. The posing's a little bit different. We also wear board shorts. So that's a new thing about it.
No Speedos.
No Speedos, yeah. So we wear board shorts. The division started in 2012. We had our first champion, Jeremy Buendia. He's actually a four-time champion. He kind of paved the way for me. He was a big inspiration for me, so I definitely have to give him a shout-out for even making that lane for someone like me. And now I'm the new champ, and we're just going to take off from here.
There's all of the spectacle of it. There's the, obviously the showbiz side of it, like you said, getting up on stage, which is part of it. But the other is in this room, in this gym.
Yep.
To go from someone who you find the endorphins being released and you're working out and your body is getting bigger and better.
Mm-hmm.
To go to where you're at now, we're on the radio, so it's hard to say. We're talking, you know, exactly as you imagine, looking at the poster you have in the gym here of Arnold Schwarzenegger. What do you have to do? Is it more mental? Is it more physical?
At this point, it's more mental. I mean, when I first started, I had to build the physique. I had to build the symmetry and the conditioning and the shape. Now, at this point, to stay at the top, it's all about mental and how do I stay there? How do I keep going when people say no? Even last year, on my way to become the Mr. Olympia, I had so many doubters saying I couldn't do it. I wouldn't win again. I wouldn't win any more shows. I was washed up. So I used that as motivation. That fear of failure was actually motivation. And anything that, even if I didn't win a show, as long as I progressed and I got better, it was always a win for me. The elf from a loss, I turned that into a learning lesson. I never really lost. Everything that I've done, I've always took it as a win. And for me to become better.
There has been such an emphasis in the last couple of years on weightlifting and just CrossFit in general. You've seen it as we stand here, people are in here.
Yeah.
Everybody's trying to better themselves in this form.
Yep.
For you to see all the people that want to remake their bodies, is that competition to you? Is it more freeing and positive that so many people want to do the kind
of things? Oh, I love it. It's all, I mean, nobody's losing anything being in this atmosphere but body fat. You know who's losing anything? Everyone in here is becoming better, no matter what age, shape, size, what color you are. Anytime I go to the gym and I see someone in there from 6 in the morning until 10 at night, there's someone always in there working, becoming better. And that's motivation for me, knowing that you don't have to stay where you're at. You can always become better. We are given an opportunity of life, but we're also given the opportunity of becoming better and making the most out of life, which is becoming better and making yourself better. So this is a huge opportunity for me.
When you go on online, you go to YouTube, you find videos of you. There's a couple of videos, but you know, you talk about what you eat. There was a whole video about what you eat, and to me, I'm like just looking at how you do it. I mean, there's so much discipline to this because it's all about calorie intake and then being able to get rid of that body fat and turn it into body muscle. How do you learn that part of it? I mean, it seemed like it was discipline. If you're late to lunch, you're in trouble.
No, the food is the main part. It's 80% of what my physique is, 80%. So it's majority of who I am and what I've become is from the diet and that consistency. And for me, when I was a kid, I started to, my diet consisted of a lot of sweet potatoes.
Okay.
So we can say I can eat a lot of calories to grow, but calories can come from anything. You can get 1,000 calories from a cheeseburger. So I don't really count calories. It's what you're eating, the macros, fats, proteins, carbs, the grams of fats, grams of those specific. So it's not all always about calories. It's just about what you eat. And as far as like meal timing, it doesn't matter what time of the day you eat. You could get up at 2 a.m. Even Ronnie Coleman, he would eat throughout the whole night. He's an 8-time Olympian. He would wake up at 2 a.m. but eat rice and chicken breast and egg whites.
Again, it's mental.
Yeah,
it's mental in choosing what you're going to eat to make your body.
And it's just being aware of what you put in is what you're going to get. So what we are now is a result of what we ate months ago. So what we become in a couple months is it will be a result of what we eat right now. So it's just about being aware of what you're putting into your body.
So as you prepare, coming up here next month, you're going to defend your title.
Yeah.
What is, when you start to lead up to it, and we're within 6 weeks of leading up, what does your life change? Does it go 24/7 getting ready for this competition?
Yep, this is all I do. I'm in the gym, 7 a.m, doing faster cardio, posing, and abs. Go right back home, shower, eat, answer emails, and I'm right back at the gym, this gym, training with my coach for a couple hours, then back home to eat. It's eat, train, sleep. That's literally all I do. Friday nights, Saturday nights, you'll see me in the gym. I don't go anywhere. I don't do anything because this is my job now.
Is it worth the sacrifice? Obviously, you're a celebrity and you're a star and you're a champion.
Yep.
If you look back in the last 7 years of your life and doing that eat, sleep, workout, is it worth it? The sacrifices you've had to make?
Yeah, I haven't been on vacation since 2012. I've literally have been doing bodybuilding consistently for 7 years, and I have no regrets because of the opportunities and the doors that's open for me and for me to become better in my life. I was once a broke college kid, real broke, you know. I had no car, no job at one point. I had to raise a GoFundMe account just to go to Nationals to get my pro card. So I know what it's like to be at the bottom, and I don't want to go back. So if this is what I have to do to never go back, then this is what I do.
You know, this is a national, international competition. I mean, yep. When you get into bodybuilding, whether it be physique or the bigger stuff with the Speedo,
yeah.
It's, I mean, we know it to be international. To be yeah. from Chicago,
yeah.
to represent and to be Mr. Olympia, what does yeah. that mean to you, being a Chicago
yeah,
kid?
Yeah, it's so cool. Like, after I won the Mr. Olympia, normally guys don't compete. Once they win the Mr. Olympia, that's all you do is Mr. Olympia. So I took a risk in actually competing after the Mr. Olympia, where I was given an opportunity to compete in Korea, Tokyo, and China. My brand is called Big Waves, so we did a Big Waves Asia tour where I actually won all three shows. So I won Mr. Olympia, went on to do Korea, Tokyo, China Pro, won all three. So right now I'm 4-for-4. But just the fact that I have the opportunity to travel the world and see people who know me, you know, they just see me on their YouTube screens, but now they're able to see me in person. And so that is just gratifying for me, and the hard work really does pay off.
Well, we'll let you get back to it, because I feel like it's like Rocky III, where you're Rocky and you're doing all the interviews and all the glam, you know, and someone else is in a gym somewhere lifting and trying to beat you. So we want you to get back to
for
that.
Sure.
Brandon Hendrickson, Mr. Olympia, who's going to be defending his title coming up here in September.
Yes.
A pleasure to talk,
yeah.
and good luck with defending the title.
Thank you so much. Yep. Thank you for this opportunity. Remember, anything is possible. It doesn't matter where you come from, who you are, anything can be done.
I'll remember that. Brandon Hendrickson, thanks again to Chicago Barbell Compound for having us up at the gym, which is up on Avondale, 6300 block of Avondale, right at the northwest tip of Chicago. More to come here on Extension 720, so stay with us. Thanks, Mr. Jennings. Extension 720, Justin Kaufman here. Gosh, man, my, you know, we were talking to Marge Helperin, I think it was early in the week. We did the Chicago neighborhood conversation in the South Loop, and I talked about crime. And she had said, well, I don't know, if you go to the South Loop community board on Facebook, they'll tell you all sorts of things about crime, right? And that's, I live, you know, my neighborhood, that's what's happening right now, where there's a couple of boards, you know, that are for every neighbor. You have one, right? Pete's got one, yeah. And it is just a laundry list of phone snatching. That's what's happening in my neighborhood in the West Loop.
Wow.
Phone snatching. So what's happening is it's just, like I said, it's just a glut of people talking about this. And it's happening, you know, all the time. They're updating, saying, oh man, this just happened. Is that if you're out on the street, and the West Loop is a very popular area, and one of the issues I have with that neighborhood, being someone who has lived in the city for a while, is that a lot of people living over there forget that they live in the city, because it's new mm-hmm. and shiny.
Yeah,
they're walking around. Yeah. So whether that's like walking in the crosswalk, taking your time, just meandering, walking, everything about that, you know, Lenny Kaufman taught me about sort of focusing, being aware of your surroundings in the city. The West Loop is not paying attention. So that makes it ripe for petty criminals to come in and be able to snatch
your phone.
Used to be purse snatching in the 70s, right? The famous kind of movie shot where some guy grabs a purse and runs, mm-hmm. knocks people down, and the one guy chases him and gets him. You know, that kind of thing. Well, now, I guess what's happening is that when you're walking down the street, and I'm guilty of this, I'm sure you are, I'm sure everyone listening who has an iPhone or an Android phone or any sort of smartphone is looking at your phone while you're walking. You're bored, you're looking at it, and you're not paying attention. And what is happening is that criminals are double parking. There's a driver. The people pop out, they come up behind, they just grab. They don't assault you necessarily. They just grab right out of your hand and jump back in the car and they're gone. And that's been happening. I'm looking at it, I was just counting it. It's five times now in the last 2 days.
Wow. Did you tell Block Club?
I haven't told anybody. I'm telling you right now. What am I talking about? I'm telling people listening in Montana right now. What have you done as a community member, Justin? Well, I just stewed on it, and then I told all the listeners in 50,000 watt blowtorch on WGN.
As a person who knows this happens, I do not. I mean, I do. I have in the past walked with my phone, mm-hmm. looking at my phone. But when I go home, like at night after the show, the phone is in the pocket, tucked in, But I don't look. Yeah, smart. I'm walking. I don't even like to wear my headphones at night.
Really? Now, do you think it makes a difference for you because you are constantly in... dangerous is not the right word. Maybe it is. But unique circumstances because you ride the train.
Take the public
You take the train home after the show, midnight, 1, 2 o'clock in the morning, whatever it might be. So you're in a position where you're heightened awareness already because... There's less people on the train. There's less authority around. You have to pay attention. So you're more focused in on self-preservation in that moment.
Yeah.
If you didn't have to do that, if you were, you know, I don't know, like me, who gets in his car when he walks to get his fancy coffee. Yeah. You know, meanders around, you know.
Yeah.
You know, I wonder if I think differently about my surroundings, even though I understand the same focus because I'm not in that surrounding.
Yeah, I do feel like during the afternoon or something or the morning when I'm coming here, I'm probably looking at my phone.
You're less
I feel comforted by, you know, the amount of people, and people are busy rushing around when it gets.
See, that's the thing on these stories in the West Loop, which I think are interesting. It's happening broad daylight. It's happening in the morning and afternoon. And it seems to be, I mean, again, this is specifically because it's being announced on the boards that are for the West Loop. I mean, it's, you know, this is happening, this is happening, this is happening, this is happening. So I'm kind of aware of it.
Is anybody else on the case? Are there photos of the perps?
Yeah, there's a photo of
is it the same person?
I don't know. You know, it quickly devolves into, I don't know what.
Oh boy.
You know, it devolves into the Trump bashing in 5 minutes, like everything on Facebook does.
Yeah.
This had nothing to do with him, but it does somehow. Somehow Trump stole your iPhone. But there was. One of the people had a picture of a white car speeding away, and it was a rideshare car. Like, it had the airport rideshare in the corner. That doesn't mean that they are driving an Uber for a living. They probably either was borrowing or stole a car in some form if they're snatching phones. So I don't know. I don't know what it means. I will say this. I was at the gas station in the neighborhood. There's one closer to the expressway I go to. And this was probably 2 weeks ago, and I had my son with me, and, you know, popped a quick get it, you know, fill it up. A guy comes up to me, which is always startling. Who comes up to anybody at a gas pump, right?
Now it's weird.
That's not etiquette.
No, don't talk to anybody at the pump.
Yeah, exactly. It's kind of like elevator talking. What are you doing?
Yeah.
So he comes up, and he's like, and he also approached it in a very kind of cautious way. It wasn't very aggressive, so I'll give him credit in that regard. It was sort of like, you know, he was kind of backing away before he talked. And he said, listen, you know, hey, I get it, and no talking at the gas pump kind of thing. But he's like, I need $5 because I need to get gas because I got to get back home to Indiana, and I messed up, and I don't have any money, and blah, blah, blah. Can you help me out? And I was like, oh, man, I got a son there, you know, part of me.
Right, wanted to go into, set an example.
Right. Yeah, exactly. Practice kindness. So I didn't have any money, any cash on me. So I kind of dug around and I got like a dollar in quarters or something. I was like, here. And, you know, it's hilarious that you said that about, you know, just, you know, the example.
Yeah.
And I got in the car and I'm like, he needed to get home and we had a little cash. And that's what good dads do. You know, I gave him one of those, you know, to my son, you know. And that's why I'm such a great person, because I gave 50 cents, I gave 78 cents to this guy who need to get back. See, that's what we do in this. Like that kind of thing. He's just looking at me like, yeah, okay, Dad. So today, before I came in, I did Mincing Rascals today, and I was coming in, and I'm like, you know, all that driving up to the barbell compound,
right?
You know, so I got to get some gas. Went to the same exact spot. Same gas station.
Same pump.
Popped out, started looking at my phone while I was waiting for it to fill up. And lo and behold, who comes around the corner but the same guy? And the same guy, in the same way, goes, excuse me, man, I'm sorry to interrupt. You know, I know it's weird, but, you know, listen, I need I need $5. And I just stopped him. And I'm like, I kind of laughed. I go, I don't want to be a jerk, man. I'm not trying to be a jerk, but you did this 2 weeks ago to me. And he looked at me, and like at that point, he had no, there was no argument for him. He wasn't like, well, you know, he didn't even do that. He just realized he was so indifferent to it. He just turned around and walked away. And he walked away kind of mad at me. You know, like he was like, and he went to the car next to me and did the same spiel while kind of keeping his eyes peeled on me, like, don't you tell on me.
Yeah. Oh.
Like that was the vibe. Like I'm trying to, let me scam this guy.
Yeah.
Because part of me is like, I want my 78 cents back. Right. 2 weeks ago. And I was leaving.
You don't think there's any chance that he's run into the same trouble?
You know, maybe there is. I got to practice kindness, but I doubt it at this point. So I'm leaving the gas station. I look over, and he's over by the wall of the gas station, which is, you know, that sort of bumps up against the next building. And I think he's with a woman, and I think they're smoking cigarettes. I'm not sure, but they're just like, it's like break time. There's nobody at the pumps right now to scam. So we'll just kind of go over there, and we're smoking. Like, yeah, that was good. That was kind of successful. I ran into a guy. He's probably telling the same story. You're not going to believe this. This guy is like, and I had half a mind, and I didn't do it. I wish I did. And I wanted to go tell the gas station owner,
yeah,
who sits in the hut, one of those with like the hut right in the middle.
Yeah, uh-huh.
It's like city gas station. He's not coming out. There's no. It's not a mini mart. It's
It's just you put the cash.
It's
in there,
like a metal slide kind of thing, right? And I use my card at the pump, so I don't even talk to
him.
But yeah, I had half a mind to go up to him and say, "What are you doing? This is your establishment. I want to come here and spend just outlandish, egregious amount of money I got to spend on gas here, and you're not protecting at all your customers. When this guy is obviously just going and standing over there and coming back, are you in on it? What's the deal? Are you scared? Is that why you're like hanging in this hut? You don't want to come out and deal with it?
Yeah, maybe he gets 20%.
Maybe he gets 20 cents off that 78 cents.
Yeah.
My guess is he just like doesn't want trouble. But I'm like, it's not good for the gas station.
Yeah,
right?
I mean, I don't. Can you? Yeah, you need to, as the owner of the gas. If maybe he might be just an employee, so maybe he didn't care. But
yeah, maybe he doesn't
care. Needs to tell somebody that hey, this guy's shooing away some bit. You know,
yeah, I'm already thinking in my head. I mean, there's gas stations every three blocks down there. I could go to a different one.
There is a, and I'm sure you've seen this person, and I'm sure tons of our listeners have seen this person. Well, there's two. There's one guy who works the corner up on Ridge and Clark and like the Peterson area.
Okay. Edgewater area, yeah.
And then his twin brother, who I believe, or a brother who looks exactly like him, works the Ridge Bryn Mawr Broadway corner.
This is a family affair.
They're always there. They got the McDonald's cup.
They're transparent, though. They're not coming up with a story. They're just at the stoplight trying to get, hey, can you give me some spare change?
No, but they kind of give you the stink eye if you don't give them anything, you know? I want it. And they've been there since they've been up there for 10 years.
Yeah.
And it makes me feel bad. And like,
No. First off, and I don't know the situation here, but I remember when I was working at WBEC, we did a story on there's a difference between the sort of homeless guy who's trying to anything to spare any money because, you know, they just want to get some money, and the panhandlers that stake a corner. And the guys who stake a corner, Linda Paul did this unbelievable story. It was award-winning, where she hung out with these guys. They're making thousands of dollars a year. This is a living wage, obviously on the lower end, salaried position. In the way that they are making, these guys kind of gave the tricks of the trade. They got enough. It's a job. So they know, on some of the more specific. It's really about the guys who are at the ramps for the expressways. You know, when you come to the end guy's there with the sign, that is hey, this is my corner. I go 9 to 5. This is my thing. I got it. Rush hours.
Yeah.
It's not as, I mean, I don't want to paint it as this is a job you want to send your resume in and do it. I'm not saying it's not worth its challenges, and it's obviously born out of despair. But I mean, it is much more living wage than you think. And there's a difference, though. And they look down on the sort of
the
people,
scammers.
The scammers and even the homeless who are just doing it because they want to get enough money to string together a bottle of liquor or whatever, or a drug fix. These guys are, can't get in gainful employment in any other form, but they go out there and they're able to score. I mean, this one guy we had in the studio, so I think he was making something like $30,000 a year. And when it was all said and done,
I mean, this guy's out there all the time,
and they have claimed that that's their claim. And someone tries it doesn't get like it's not like Wild Wild West where someone tries to claim the Terry Fedora. But there's almost like a network where they know.
And I you know like I've thought about like I can't go I don't want to go this way because he was gonna be angry. He gives you a menacing look.
That's his sales tactic.
And then sometimes I'm like oh perfect. There's a lot of traffic. I'm gonna be too many cars back. He's never gonna reach me by the time yeah, right. you know by the time the yeah, light change
right,
by
right,
the light
right.
changes. But they're out there and they're and then the other day he was eating an orange on the you know on his break.
Yeah, and Whole Foods.
Tossed out the peel, just dropped the peel on the ground too, littering.
Well, it's biodegradable. It's, a, it's yeah, an orange, still. But still, yeah. I have a funny story before we take the break that when I was doing sketch comedy, Schadenfreude in Rogers Park. So Rogers Park at the Heartland Cafe in the back, they had the Heartland Studio. And it was a small black box theater on Glenwood that fit about 50, 60 people, but it was a pretty kind of shady little area. Every night when the audience would come out, we'd greet them out on the street, and they would mull about us and maybe go to the bar next door, or they would leave. The L was right there. There was a guy who'd walk up, and his story was, oh, man, I can't believe this. I ran out of gas or something. I just need to get to Gurney. That's what he always say. I got to get to Gurney. And you know, the first time around, you're like, all right. Nah. And someone would be like, okay, let me give you $5 or something like that. He'd be like, thank you. But we would do the show every Friday and Saturday night, and we'd be up there all the time. So he became kind of a regular, became we because we, you know, the new audience didn't know, but we did as the actors that he was, here he's throwing Gurney out again. Every Friday and Saturday, he's like, if I could just get to Gurney. So we the next time he did it, I was like, oh, this is going to be great. And Sandy Marshall is one of the guys in the group. He was hilarious because he's like, the joke was he would come up. He came up, finally came up, and he's like, yeah, I'm just trying to get to Gurney. I'm like, excuse me, did you say Gurney? You're going to Gurney? Sandy, you're not going to believe this guy's going to Gurney. He comes running out. He goes, Gurney, oh, my God, that's where I'm going. I'm going to Gurney. Come on, Bob, get in the car with me. He's like, and he runs. He gets his jacket. He gets his tees. And he like, kind of carries him a little bit. He's like, this is going to be great. What kind of music do you like? I usually take this ride by myself, and no one ever wants a Gurney with me. Like, it was this great bit. And the guy's just like, all right. The guy was awesome because he was just like, knock it off. Like, he was just sort of like, all right, I get you. I won't bother you guys anymore. It was so funny. Sandy goes, what kind of music you like? I would do this by myself. It's going to be great. I think he'd like name some artists. He's like, I've got Smash Mouth. I've got other things. Whatever you need, man. This is going to be great. Where? What part of Gurney do you live? That's a great bit. Great bit. So maybe that's what I got to do next time that I go to the gas station. And guy goes, I just got to get to Indiana. I'm like, I'm going to Indiana. Let's go, buddy. All right. Take a break. Come back. Extension 720 wrapping up here. A rare Friday night Extension 720. Usually the White Sox are playing a night game. They got day game today. They watch Field of Dreams afterwards at the park. They're all Field of Dreams crazy. Gwen's on the line. She has an experience actually with people asking for money at the gas station. Hi, Gwen.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call. I was like you, pumping my gas, and where I seen a group of kids or young adults, there's three boys and one girl, and there's of course there's one joker in the group, one of the young men, and he kind of, after I finished with he seen that I was getting ready to leave, and they kind of started inching over. There was nobody else there. And well, it's a really well-lit area. There's another gas station across the street and the Blue Line or the Metro, whatever. This is Jefferson Park, Montrose and Cicero. So long story short, the silly young man comes over and he's joking around and goes, can we get a ride from you? And I was like, and I go, I says, well, where are you heading? He goes, Skokie. I says, let me guess. You just missed that last Cicero bus because the bus does stop at 9 o'clock.
Yeah.
So I says, okay. I says, he goes, we have no money on our Uber account. He goes, our phones are dying out. And this is going to, so after I go back in, and I said to the gas station attendant, I says, you know, I says, you got a cab company? He goes, I don't know cab. He goes, then he comes out and he looks at all the kids. He goes, I'm going to call the police. Now, there's three Afro-American young men and one girl that was with them. They all looked very clean cut, you know, like minding their own business.
Yeah.
Well, no, I prevented that from happening. I told them, oh, I went into, when I asked for the address from the attendant, he goes, I'm going to call the police. And I ran out, and then he says to me, because you got to move your car. This is after I pumped gas, and my 20, I gave them $25 the gas. Well, that's what my car needed, 20. So anyways, I moved over to the side. Go, guys, we got to get away from the pumps. I said, I will get you a cab. So then to add to what I called 16th District, which is located in the area, please give me a taxi. So I got to get these teenagers out of, you know, get them home.
Right.
I said, and so they gave me a number, and as I'm calling for the taxi,
another taxi
tow truck. Well, no, a tow truck pulls up to the pump where I was at, and I go inside, and luckily, to the ATM to get more money to pay the cab driver. The cab driver pulls up in 5 minutes, and they all jumped in, and I go to give the cab driver the 20. Oh, and before that, I gave the girl, I only had $9 cash on me. I go, this is all I got, but I'll get you guys more. And luckily, it was only $20 to get him out. Go.
Yeah. Well, there you go. That's very nice.
You know, we are hearing about all these crazy things that happen to kids. Like this guy was going to escalate to calling the police on them.
Right.
And
you didn't need to. They just wanted to get home, right?
Yeah, and they were so grateful. And I asked the one kid, I said, honestly, is your mom around? He goes, no, she works. I'm thinking, oh, she probably works at a hospital or some night job or something. Yeah. But
maybe she's a talk show host.
Yeah, but no, I know what you mean about panhandlers, but I could tell they were scared.
Yeah.
They were really scared. When the attendant said, first he was so rude, he goes, I'm going to call the police. Then I see a tow truck ready to take my car.
Yeah, that's
literally.
Sound good. Yeah.
No, well, you know, Glenn, and this is the north side, but thanks for taking my call.
No, thanks for calling in. That's good. That's good that not you can't always judge a book by its cover and a nice deed. See, she's practicing kindness. Giving her hard-earned money to some kids to get them home. And there you go. All right, that's going to do it for Extension 720 tonight. John Hansen coming up next here on 720 WGN.